bit of change of pace today. We are at the point of shlokas 2 and 3, as well as 4, but 2 and 3 particularly, in anthropogenesis. And so I thought I'd talk a little bit first about this in terms of really, again, the pattern that is revealed. The question came up, of course, about how Lucifer came to be thought of as the bad guy in the whole process, Satan in the Christian church, and he has a very bad reputation. But I think we ought to dust up his reputation, dust it off, and restore him to his proper position as Lucifer, and see really what is meant. This involves what's called the war in heaven, in the tradition where Lucifer is kicked out, if you remember, and we have everything going on. Now, in a sense, this is the pattern that is set in shlokas 2 and 3. So while I will be taking these up in detail when we resume our series in the studies of the secret doctrine, it's a useful point to stand aside for a moment. Shloka 2 begins with an appeal by the earth to the Lord of the Shining Face, who is Surya, or the sun. So I've put the versus because, in a sense, we now have an opposition. And this really is fundamental to the pattern of the whole creative process. We are in a universe based on a subtle balancing of opposite tensions. And it really stems, if we can put it this way, from the godly level, or the level of the highest intelligences. Now, we have come to, I think, designate these, therefore, with moral valuations of good and bad. And this is unfortunate. So I think we need to, again, put aside that and see that what we're dealing with are two great forces, two tremendous forces. Incidentally, I'm taking some of this introductory material from the new work, which I think is not yet available in this country, although it's been ordered, and I was fortunate enough to be given the first copy from the press, from the publisher. Isn't that marvelous? Janine Miller's The Vision of Cosmic Order in the Vedas. And some of you have been here when Janine has given series and know what a tremendous student she is. And when I was in England this summer, she had written me in advance that she expected this book to be available, and it wasn't, but when I saw her for the last time in my visit in England, she said, "I'm giving you the very first copy the publisher has just sent me, hot off the press, because I want you to have it." And the foreword is by Dr. Raimundo Panikkar, who will be giving a seminar for us in early April. Dr. Panikkar is a professor of religious studies at University of California in Santa Barbara. And I've been in touch with him, and he said, "Oh, I hoped you'd ask me sooner." And I said, "I haven't any place on the program sooner." So he said, "April, then definitely must come." And the foreword is by him. So much of this I am really taking because, you know, why should I do all the work when it's been done by somebody else? Isn't this right?
Yeah.
Take whatever. In any event, it's been ordered by our bookstore. It's published by Routledge Kegan Paul. It's been ordered from the Boston branch of Routledge Kegan Paul, but it hasn't, I think, hasn't come in yet. At least Zella has not notified me. She usually does when it comes in. But I really strongly recommend it. The Vision of Cosmic Order in the Vedas. And later on, on the other side of the board, I'm going to, because there is so much in the secret doctrine dealing with the Hindu mythology and the Hindu text and the Rig Veda and so on, I thought I'd give you a little lesson in the literature of India and show you where these things fit in.
Excuse me, Joy, have you had time to read it yet?
Most of it, yes.
I'm just wondering whether, I don't want to interrupt your discourse,
yes,
but whether there's reasonable correlation between that presentation and the secret doctrine.
Oh, indeed, yes. Indeed, yes. Of course, Janine, being a deep student of the secret doctrine, has done a great deal of the correlation without mentioning the secret doctrine.
Oh, yes. They do correlate.
Oh, very much so. Yes, very much so. It really is marvelous. Of course, much of it is based on the Rig Veda, in which she's an expert, of course, but she's a student of the Vedas and Sanskrit, as well as Egyptology, too, you may know. She is a tremendous student of Egyptology.
Well, as you know, she's coming to the Australian
Yes,
convention.
I know she is. You're very lucky. Because she is an unusual, unique person. Have you met her?
Not yet.
Oh, she's a tremendous person, absolutely tremendous. In any event, because in a sense these two shlokas, said the earth and said the Lord of the Shining Face, we have a kind of opposition set up, and that's why I've put verses, because of course the earth at this stage is very eager to get on with having itself peopled, you see. My house is empty. I want someone here. Let me get on, you know. And the Lord of the Shining Face, just wait. Your work hasn't commenced yet. I'll send you a fire when your work is commenced. There's preparatory work to be done. So there are two forces, what we can call the force construction, of expansion, of moving ahead, and the force that is restrictive, that is felt always as somehow holding us in bondage, pulling us back. We get this in the Mahatma letters, one of Virginia's favorite quotations. Okay, you give it.
Well, I probably won't be able to give it precisely now, but he speaks of, it's part of the sentence, it isn't the whole sentence, and he speaks of the countless cosmical influences which distort and deflect all efforts to achieve purpose.
Yes. So
in other words, frustration.
Frustration. And one feels this terrific frustration in Shloka 2 of the planetary spirit of the earth, this tremendous frustration. You've done this for... You've sent your seven sons to the Lord of Wisdom, which is Mercury. We've talked about the sacred planets. You've brought Mercury closer to you. You've done all of this. And now do it for me. Send now to thy servant the same. And this, of course, I put up there. It's in the fourth round. And the Lord of the Shining Face, as I say, says, you're not ready yet. I will give you what you need, but there's preparation to be done. You must first apply to others who will help you. Raise thy voice to other lokas. Apply to thy father, the Lord of the Lotus, who is, of course, the moon, Soma. And then says, and it's a marvelous phrase, I think, and I think it's why, you know, HPB left out, as we know, a great deal from these stanzas and shlokas. But I think it's interesting what she put in. And she put in this, cease thy complaints. I think it's marvelous. I mean, it's something she could have left out, probably. But it makes it almost human, doesn't it? Almost human. Cease thy complaints. you're just not ready yet. And so, you know, and I think we all become impatient. Is that right, Diana?
Oh, yes.
You know, let's get on with it and cease thy complaints. Now, because of this real opposition, which really has come, the moment of manifestation brings into play, if we can put it this way, the two opposing forces. One energy, one force, but which seems to have in it both the positive and negative aspects. And it's because of this, in one sense, that the gods even encounter opposition in their constructive work of laying down the laws and bringing about the various realms of the universe. And these two opposing factors really were expressed in the Vedas particularly, and in other traditions, not only there, of course, in the Judaic Christian tradition, I should say, because it's not simply Christian, it's Judaic Christian tradition also, in the enmity between certain categories of great beings, gods. The tension and conflict is there. And of course, in Hindu mythology, it becomes a never-ending struggle between the good guys and the bad guys. It becomes and of course, much of Hindu mythology is concerning this struggle. If you go to Adyar on any occasion, and then during the period of the festival of Kalakshetra, which is right next to Adyar, Tiruvannamar, and see some of these great classical dramas that Rukmini Devi has choreographed and set to music. Marvelous. I always enjoy these, I must say, and tremendous dramas that Rukmini has done, the great classical dramas in the Bharatanatyam form, of course, of dance. These portray again and again this tremendous conflict, and it becomes this struggle between the gods and the demons. And unfortunately, between those who have come to be called the demons, whose real name is the Asuras. And so I've put it here, these two opposing forces, the Adityas, who are the sons of Aditi, which of course means the boundless, the infinite, the all-pervasive. It is equivalent in one sense, it's a term also equivalent partially to Akasha, Aditya. So in a sense it's the sun, you see, Surya, the boundless, which shines over everything, and the Asuras, or in the Vedas sometimes called the Dalavas. Now, here's where one has to be very careful with Sanskrit, because often in front of a word is said to mean not. You immediately think this is not the gods. But the word asura does not divide that way. The word is asu and ara. This is the derivation in this case. Asu means breath-giving or life-giving, and Ra is simply the possessive, those who possess this quality of granting or giving breath or life energy. But they become the restrictive ones. They give only so much, so to speak. And so what really distinguishes the Asuras is that they do create, they're creative beings, particularly in the Rig Veda, And they are a category, they're all devas, both the Adityas and the Asuras are devas. And only later does this Asura seem to now become the demon, because he isn't as expansive, he's not boundless as the Adityas, the sons of Aditya. It's interesting how these things, you see, come to be later categorized. Now, it's true that among the Asuras, some, it is said, belonged to the dark side and some to the light side. In one sense, it's already inherent there. This is the way in which the Hindu mythology frequently tries to solve these paradoxes. Now, the Danavas, and they're sometimes called the Danavas, from Danu, which is a word which means actually restraint, So these are the forces of bondage or restraint. And consequently, on this side, we have those who stand for freedom, for light, for expansion, and those, this becomes indeed the war in heaven, which is spoken of in some of the early texts. These stand then for bondage, darkness, constriction. But the interesting thing is that they, both sides, use the original energy, which is Maya. Both of them use Maya. Now, in the early Rigvedic days, the seven Adityas, and it's interesting that there were originally seven, you see, are said to face the seven Asuras. So there were seven. It's interesting. According to Janine, I'll just read a portion of this. In the Adityas, we discern the principle of expansion, freedom, light, the forces of evolution, constructing and supervising a world where law reigns supreme. In the opposing forces, the Danavas, which will become the Asuras of later meaning, we notice the principle of constriction, bondage. Danu, bondage or restraint, is the mother of Vritra, the constrictor, and of the seven Danavas. So the seven Adityas face the seven Asuras or Danavas. It's rather interesting. So that there is always a counteracting force. Matter, antimatter, there is always this counteracting force. And in the Rig Veda, Vritra is indeed called the dragon of obstruction. Isn't that a marvelous term? And he receives good attention, you know, a lot is given to him, to Vritra, which is the dragon. Now, the conflict is, of course, then originally between the Asuras and the Adityas. And these opposing forces are really the sons, it is said, of the same father, Prajapati, the Lord of Being. So that they really come from the same source. The primordial gods, in other words, born in the undifferentiated state prior to differentiation that becomes the cosmos, embody a kind of self-assertive principle. And this is present from the beginning, a self-assertive principle.
Is that the same thing that Janine Miller told us about, I think 2 years ago, about the churning of the waters?
Yes, that's right. That's right. That's right. This, of course, ties right in with that wonderful myth that she told us, yes, of the churning of the waters of space.
Yes.
you see. And we have the freedom and the constriction.
One force there.
That's right. And one trying to pull the tail and so on. Yes, all of that. Marvelous. So we begin to see that right from the very beginning, and this is fundamental to all the development of our humanity. Fundamental, and that's why I thought, well, I'll spell us a bit and bring this in. All of our development, immediately, with differentiation, there is the self-assertive principle of consciousness capable of breaking through the status quo, if you like, and piercing through the state of darkness or undifferentiation. And in fact, then, the later scriptures of India do begin to associate the asuras with darkness or night, and the devas with day, and therefore the adityas. It becomes really very explicit in the Puranas, and I'll explain a bit where the Puranas fit in. So self-assertion is essential to manifestation, and it is fundamental in us. I think it was it you, John, mentioned yesterday, the fact that each of us progresses independently, as it were. There is an independent consciousness in each one of us. Am I quoting you correctly, John? There is this independence. On the other hand, we need each other. And as we know, from psychological studies, individuals, wolf children and so on, infants who have been left to be brought up by wolves and so on, the so famous wolf children of France and so on, do not become really human. And so too much isolation, too much constriction, too much bondage results in a non-human state. Too great freedom, too much light, as it were, can blind us, can lead also to a non-human state. And we walk a middle path. Mm-hmm. Both forces within us.
See how necessary that is.
Yes.
The principle of frustration, since the asuras are breath-giving or what it does, what frustration does is to build up energy.
Yes.
Now, then we can take that energy and accept it. We can accept the darkness, the bondage, the constriction, as belonging to us, but transform it from the dark side to the light side.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that's what frustration does.
That's what really frustration does, doesn't it? Yes.
And it said one amusing illustration that I read along that line was that oysters, if there weren't some check on the root of oysters, in the eighth generation they would be out to get how many times the size of the earth?
Yes.
So we'd be smothered
in oysters. We'd be smothered in oysters. God forbid.
I puzzled over this a long time ago and kept wondering why there has to be a paradox. Always.
Yes, always.
No matter what you attempt,
yes,
to go so far, and it becomes paradoxical. Mm-hmm. And it finally broke through to me that the balance is what is required.
That's what's required. That's right.
Go all
and
far.
This, you see, this is why, again, I'd like to stress the reason for bringing this all in, the fourth is always the balance, remember. It's always the transition from the first three to the second three in any seven. The fourth is always the balance. And our humanity is on the fourth round, the fourth globe. We're just past that point. But our task then is to bring this balance. And this is one of the things we're having a lot of difficulty with, isn't it? Tremendous difficulty with, is bringing about this balance. So this is, again, a very good reason for for looking at this today.
I remember when you began the secret doctrine that you mentioned.
I'm glad somebody remembers that. It was ages ago, wasn't it, Ruth?
Well, it made an impression on me because I come back to the people who would bring the same thing. Mm-hmm. And they say, and you said, that manifestation as such, when it starts, when it starts, mm-hmm. brings in the unbalance, brings mm-hmm. light
right.
and darkness
mm-hmm.
through the manifestation.
That's right.
Itself.
Yes.
And when we work through the manifestation in one manvantara, mm-hmm. at the end of that manvantara, it's all balanced out, and then we have pralaya.
Then we have pralaya. Yes. Yes. No, it's a marvelous thing. So you see, the action of the asuras, the action on this side, as it were, is towards differentiation. It's a divisive intelligence. It's the sword which is given to Parsifal, which is the first gift that the innocent hero receives. Because the sword is two-edged. It is discrimination. It cuts. It therefore, by cutting, perceives. And all of us, I'm sure, are familiar with psychological experiments of figure and ground, of what you see. Do you see the ground or do you see the figure? And so on. You see. You see this because, you see this in red or in blue, because of the white background, the ground, the figure is there. You can see it, however, if you really look at it closely, as the white coming forward, the white ground, you see, and perhaps the background is all red and I have just put the white there.
Co-defining.
Yes, co-defining. So you see, this is really the function of the asuras, to establish then the basis for ultimate self-consciousness, to make it possible to live separate existence, or, as we often say, to make cosmos out of chaos, to make a world out of the undifferentiated state of darkness that prevailed. And so all the great asuras are examples of self-assertion of very high intelligence, breaking through the circle of darkness, demarcating the various realms of the manifested world. And of course, the most popular figure in the Vedic tradition and even into Hindu mythology later is Indra, the god who has 1,000 powers, the active sovereign in the Vedic literature, who asserts his own separate existence by emerging from the mother, Aditi, from cosmic space, and by rending asunder the dragon of matter. He was the original Saint George, was Indra, head of the gods in the Vedic times. He set the sun on high, he released all the rivers, hit 1,000 powers. And throughout the Rig Veda, he's called an asura, which is rather interesting. Now, as I say, both sides, both elements, because they really are all the same, because asurship really refers to a certain intelligence, a certain status, if you like, attained, characterized by the ability to use the primordial power in the universe. And that creative power, which is the possession of all the devas, is called Maya, the original power. And this is interesting because in the Vedas, Maya represents three different powers, and it's used by both sides. They both wield the same weapon. That's what's so interesting. I often compare it to the fact that we may say that the lower mind, our go into some of our traditional terminology. The lower mind gets in our way. It's a real, you know, stumbling block and obstruction, and we over-intellectualize and over-analyze and so on. On the other hand, the lower mind has its uses. It has a very real function. It distinguishes figure from ground. It discriminates, really. It's what cuts and analyzes and looks at and perceives. So it has its uses. I'm always one who believes that you can't throw out anything and certainly don't slay anything until you find out whether it might be useful to you or not. That doesn't mean to clutter up with everything that you may not ultimately need. You've heard my story of the little lady who died, and when they went through her things, they found one box marked "string too short to be used." I think we should get rid of the string that's too short to be used, you know, not just tuck it away in a box. But on the other hand, let's not get rid of anything that we might someday find useful. So when we talk about slaying the mind, you know, it's harder. One of the difficult powers is resurrection. That's one of the later siddhis, if I can put it that way. So don't slay anything till you're sure you really want to get rid of it. So consequently, both aspects of us use the same power. There's only one power, as it were, and that is power of Maya. It's what's known as Maya. Of course, Maya, the root verb ma, is to measure. Now, what do we measure? We measure out the existence and so on. It's measurability. But in the Veda, in the Rig Veda, it has three different meanings. It's, first of all, what is often called the supernatural power of the gods, and it's attributed especially to Indra and Varuna and Mitra, to transform themselves above all. And so in the Rig Veda we see, through his power of Maya, Indra wanders in many forms. Harnessed are his 1,000 horses. Notice, harnessed. He knows how to use this. He has them all harnessed. For most of us, the horses are unharnessed, aren't they? And pull us in all directions. But it's the power to transform. But it's also often, very often used in the Rig Veda to indicate the power that sustains the world, that maintains the separate existence in order that consciousness can focus and can become self-consciousness. If the sun, for example, gave everything right away to the earth pleads and says, you know, give me this. And the sun says, fine, I'll give it to you all at once. What would happen? The earth would have been destroyed before we even got going. You see. So it's the power to sustain, to nourish. And it also is the power, and I've put in quotes, to deceive. It's the power that enables them to sort of subtly trick us. And there is that power in the universe that sort of trips us up. You know, we may not like it, this bit of trickery, but because it transforms itself, it sort of tricks us. And so both of these power, both of the Adityas and the Asuras deceive each other, veil each other, you see. And sometimes, consequently, and this is what becomes rough at times, the Adityas appear as Asuras, and the Asuras, or the Danavas, appear as Adityas, because they can transform themselves and they have a certain cunning to it. So this is very important to notice. It's the creative power, and it's a skill that's the prerogative of all the intelligences. So it's on both sides. Both sides. Of course, perhaps the power to deceive is used more often by the asuras, and one gets very funny episodes in some of the classical myths of India. Very, very funny. I don't have any to tell you at the moment because I can't remember them at the moment, but there's some very funny episodes where they sort of put on guise and trick the Adityas, sort of lure them into eating the butter or consuming the cream, all very interesting. So all of it, again, is to forward, of course, the whole system towards self-consciousness. Now, one of the interesting passages towards the end of this section of these first four shlokas, this begins on page 47, HPB has a section called Two Antediluvian Astronomers, a rather interesting section. And she says that two figures are indissolubly connected with mystic astronomy, chronology, and their cycles. Two grand and mysterious figures, towering like two giants in the archaic past, emerge before him, that is, before the student, and that few men know of these. They are prehistoric. And he speaks of the mystic West and Freemasonry talk loudly of Enoch and Hermes. The mystic East speaks of Narada, the old Vedic Rishi, and Asuryamaya, the Atlantean. Well, obviously, therefore, history does not record these. But in what is known as the Fourth Veda, which was said to come many, many centuries after the first three Vedas, as I'll talk about in a little, well, may not until after the tea break. In that Veda, there is reference made to Asuryamaya, which is rather interesting. Now, you have to get used to the fact that these names appear again and again. I mean, it's sort of like having Smith and Jones in the Vedas, or in the London telephone directory, there are more Patels than anybody, any other name now. You know, Mills appears everywhere too. So you can't always say, but the original Asuryamaya was evidently in the Atharva Veda. And there referred to this ability to use all of these three powers of Maya. Asuryamaya, it was the Asurya's ability to use all of these powers. The divine creative power, the power of transformation, and later, of course, to be used for deceptive purposes. And I thought it was rather interesting that appears to be the first use of that name, Asuryamaya, is in the fourth Veda, Atharva Veda. Now, Narada, of course, who HBB calls a Vedic Rishi, and I think I have time, maybe not, to share with you from the Hindu mythology, because Hindu mythology treats of this riddle of Maya very interestingly. And in Heinrich Zimmer's little work, Myths and Symbols in Indian Art and Civilization, one finds some of these tales that have been handed down by, of course, oral communication. And the story is told of Narada. Now, Narada was a great ascetic, and he was on what we call the Bhakti Marga, the path. Usually, you know, we define Bhakti, and this I think is rather interesting, because all of the asuras basically are on the path of Bhakti. But the original meaning of Bhakti is participation. may not know that, so I'm giving it to you. We think of it as devotion, but the original meaning of bhakti was participation, participation by sharing. And so, I think it's extremely interesting. We're a participatory universe. These were the participants. They participated in the total creative process. Therefore, they were supreme bhaktis. I think it's very interesting. And that's why they performed tapas, as it's known. That is to say, ascetic practices, although the word tapas simply means heat. And it's a kind of internal heat, a brooding, which by internally heating bursts open that which is within. And so Narada is, of course, the favorite model of in Hindu mythology of the devotee who is the bhakti, who is the participant in all of this. And it's, I think, rather, because the bhakta is one who gives his share, who especially gives of himself. And both of these forces, therefore, of the adityas and the asuras, are within us. We participate in them. As we certainly know, we're both gods and demons, you know, aren't we? The both the energies. And therefore, we're developing our ability to use Maya. Well, Narada, after long austerity, finally saw a vision of Vishnu. He was a devotee of Vishnu, of course. And Vishnu appears to him and instructs him. And this is in one of the Puranas. We'll get into where these fit into the whole system of Hindu literature. Of course, when Vishnu appears to Narada, Narada says, I want to know something. You see, always this is the basis. You find this in the Upanishads, you find this again and again. Not until we ask questions of the gods do they give us any answers. This, I think, is why Shloka 2 comes before Shloka 3, why the earth appeals to the sun. Why the earth, in other words, we must ask the question first before the answer is given, before instruction is given. This is fundamental to the esoteric tradition. Not until we knock will the door be opened. We get this, of course, in the Christian tradition. So that the effort must come, as it were, from the reflection to that which has made the reflection possible. It's rather interesting. And this, again, is repeated. It's repeated again and again. It's a central theme that we have to ask. And so until the earth asks of the Lord of the Shining Face, does it get any answer? The Lord of the Shining Face, the sun, isn't there saying, now look, I've got you out there, earth. When you're ready, I'll do whatever is necessary, and so on. Earth appeals first. And this, I think, is again part of this pattern. And this is true with Narada. Narada says, what I want to know is, in fact, he puts it this way, unveil the secret of your Maya. And of course, you see, it's said then that, and this is, it's recounted by the great saint of Hinduism, Vyasa, who can comprehend the Maya of the highest God except himself? I can only tell you a tale. I can only recite how this Maya really works. But why don't you ask for something else? You remember in the Katha Upanishad, when the young boy Nachiketas asks Yama, tell me the secret, you see, and Yama says, well now, little boy, ask for anything else. Why don't you ask for some candy or, you know, a nice warm bed or something? Just go home and, you know, I'll give you anything. No, I want the secret. I want to know whether life continues. What is the secret of death of Yama? And finally, Yama is forced to tell him, you see. And this is interesting. And here Narada says, I want that only. Don't pawn off anything else. I don't want any of the lesser mysteries. I want the one thing. What is the secret of your Maya? Well, I'll leave you in suspense. Is the power of earth itself, in terms of constantly producing changing forms, the growth of plants, is Maya, is due to Maya. The change of leaf to blood, bud to flower, back to seed again, is the power of Maya. The metamorphosis of grub to butterfly is Maya. This is the power which Earth possesses, and which ultimately too, because you remember in the third shloka, said the Lord of the Shining Face, I shall send thee a fire when thy work is commenced. Now this in the Rig Vedic terms is Agni, who of course possesses the supreme power of Maya, which then Earth possesses in turn. It's a point that I failed to make, so I just want to pick that up. The growth of the embryo is Maya. I think we don't often think of this, so that it is present throughout. And so the whole law of cycles is Maya, is this power of transformation and sustaining. And this is made very clear in the Rig Veda. Well, back to the story of Narada, which you wanted to know, which I left you at that crucial point, where the God has said, no one can comprehend my Maya, no one has ever comprehended it. But he, of course, Narada insisted, and so finally Vishnu says, plunge into yonder water and you shall experience the secret of my Maya. Narada dived into the pond. He emerged again in the shape of a girl. Narada stepped out of the water as Sushila, the virtuous one, the daughter of the king of Benares. And presently, when she was in the prime of her youth, her father bestowed her in marriage on the son of the neighboring king of Vidarbha. The holy seer and ascetic, in the form of a girl, fully experienced the delights of love. In due time, then, the old king of Vidarbha died, and Sushila's husband succeeded to the throne. The beautiful queen had many sons and grandsons and was incomparably happy. However, in the long course of time, a feud broke out between Sushila's husband and her father, and this developed presently into a furious war. Notice again this war that we've talked about, these opposing forces. Here's the young and the old, opposing forces. In a single mighty battle, many of her sons and grandsons, and when we say her, remember this is Narada in the form of this beautiful girl, many of her sons and grandsons, her father and her husband were all slain. And when she learned of the Holocaust, she proceeded in sorrow from the capital to the battlefield, there to lift a solemn lament. And she ordered a gigantic funeral pyre and placed upon it the dead bodies of her relatives, her brothers, sons, nephews, and grandsons, and then side by side the bodies of her husband and her father. With her own hand she laid torch to the pyre, and when the flames were mounting, cried aloud, my son, and when the flames were roaring, threw herself into the conflagration. The blaze became immediately cool and clear. The pyre became a pond. And amidst the waters, Sushila found herself again as the holy Narada, and the god Vishnu, holding the saint by the hand, was leading him out of the crystal pool. After the god and the saint had come to the shore, Vishnu asked with an equivocal smile, "Who is this son whose death you are bewailing?" Narada stood confounded and ashamed. The god continued, "This is the semblance of my Maya, woeful, somber, accursed. Not the lotus-born Brahma, nor any other of the gods, Indra, nor even Shiva, can fathom its depthless depth. Why or how should you know this inscrutable?" So there is the power we all have, all possess. And of course, then there's another very interesting one. If time permits later, I'll share the other one about Narada. But this, you see, may be this Vedic Rishi of whom HPB speaks, who learned from Vishnu the ultimate power. This representative of every human being who is learning how to wield the ultimate energy of the universe. And we get ourselves caught, transformed by this energy, sustained by it, and also deceived by it, because we deceive ourselves by it. Well, as I said at the outset, I thought because we are again and again referring, and HPB of course refers a great deal to many of the Hindu texts, that it might be useful for those of you not familiar with the various texts and their order to give you just a little bit of this. Now, the Vedas, this word Veda, is of course from vid, which has a great number of meanings: to know, to understand, to perceive, to learn, to be conscious of, to observe, to remember. Great number of meanings, but generally means sacred or perfect knowledge. Vid is to see, just simply to see, so that here the different from asura, is non-seeing, and ya as the function of non-seeingness, translated often as ignorance, which is also non-seeing. You see, gnosis, to see. Now, this is a group of texts, then, which are said to be prehistory. Three of them, in the earliest works, there's said to be the names of the works which constitute the earliest foundations of the Hindu tradition. And three are generally mentioned. They're called the Triple Veda, the Triple Knowledge, and this you'll see referred to again and again. This was the Triple Knowledge. The Rig Veda as the oldest. I put the I in, although usually it's written thus, with the dot under the R, because R is a vowel, not the R, which is the consonant, but R. But I've put it the R-I-G, which is easier, is the oldest, and said to have come before the Aryans settled in India. It's said that this was given by the great rishis, that it was brought from Atlantis, and that it's been handed down from time immemorial. They are hymns, of course. It's the only original work of all the Vedas, it's said. And many of the hymns of the Rig Veda are repeated in the Yajur Veda and the Sama Veda. Actually, there are two kinds of Yajurveda. There's the white and the black, which is rather interesting. Immediately you have a distinction. Both the Yajurveda and the Samaveda are full of chants, of metrical hymns, of summons, as they're called. And actually, in the Samaveda, is the science of music given, which is rather interesting. It's the earliest science of music. After some time, now no one knows how long, but just after some time, came the Atharva Veda, sometimes called the Atharvavana Veda, but the Atharva Veda, which is the one to which we've referred and in which Asuramaya appears. This contains the most profound philosophy. It's rather interesting. But it's also full of magic spells and what we would call witchcraft. If you want to know what the earliest witchcraft was, you can read that. But because by this time, some of the gods of the Rig Veda now are exhibiting their powers of Maya. Now, all of these are said to be Srutis, all of the Vedas, and they are the only ones in Hindu literature said to be Srutis. That is to say that they were heard, because the word Shruti comes from Shru, which is to hear, to listen. And it is said that the great rishis, the wise people, the sages, who passed on the wisdom to our humanity, heard these hymns. They listened. They gave ear to them. And so Shruti also means that they were attentive, to be attentive and to be heard. And all scriptures are divided into Shrutis and Smritis. It's a nice word, isn't it? Those which were heard and those which were learned or studied or remembered. The word Smriti actually means to remember, to recollect, to be mindful. It also has the meaning of being handed down. So it's said that the Shrutis came from the divine teachers of humanity, and the Smritis were remembered by human teachers. Rather interesting. Now all the Vedas, therefore, were heard. They were communicated from the beginning, from the divine teachers of our humanity. And therefore they must be chanted. And anyone who really reads them correctly would chant them. Obviously, I am not. Now, each Veda has four divisions. Within each of these Vedas, there are four divisions. The first is the Samhita, which consists of the mantras, or the chants. Those which are really then have a mantric power. They are the hymns to the gods. They are poetical. They are the invocations. And they are the mantras. Then come the brahmanas, brahmana section, which are the precepts for proper worship, for sacrifice, and contain, therefore, of course, also great philosophical truths, but also very much the proper way to do things, the instructions, how you perform a ritual, you see. The third, which is often called the end of the brahmanas, are the aranyaka, that's a Y in there in case you can't read it, aranyaka, which simply, incidentally, the word means a forest dweller. And these were instructions for those who had renounced the world, who went into the forest. These are specific instructions only for the great ascetics, who renounce the world. And of course, the fourth is called the philosophical side, the philosophical discourses, the Upanishads. So the Upanishads are always the fourth side, of the Vedas, sometimes therefore simply referred to as Vedanta, the end of the Vedas. But they are all the great Upanishads. Now, it is also said, incidentally, that the entire Veda, all of the Vedas, are comprised in the Gayatri Mantra. That if you know fully and perfectly the Gayatri Mantra, which I won't attempt to chant, Felix could chant it, I know, if I'd given him any warning on it, but within the Gayatri Mantra is said to be all of the Vedas. Everything that was heard can be compressed. And this is rather interesting, because just as H.P.B. said that at this manuscript that she was looking at, you know, had these few simple symbols, and that all of an understanding of the cosmogonic processes were contained within these few simple symbols, so it is said in the Gayatri, all that is in the Vedas is there. If you could understand perfectly the essence, if you could understand it, you would have all of the Gayatri. Well, as I say, so I just thought that might help you to understand that. The next set of texts, which came later, are known as the Smritis, and the main Smritis are the Dharmashastras, obviously related to Dharma, codes of conduct, which regulated then the national, social, family, and individual obligations. And it is said that in the original Dharmashastras, there were 1,000,000 rules in 1,000 chapters. Isn't that nice to know? Narada, this great sage Narada, after his instruction from Vishnu, reduced those 1,000,000 rules to 12,000. It's rather interesting. And now it is said that in the Dharmashastras, what remains to us are about 3,000 verses in 12 books. And of course, Annie Besant translated some of these in her textbook of what's it called? The textbook of, I never can remember its proper name. Anyone remember for me? Anyway, she did two textbooks on Hinduism, on the Dharma and code of conduct, which is still used in schools in India. And she translated a number of them. So the Dharmashastras are extremely interesting. These contain the code of Manu and so on, all of that. Now, the next group of texts, and these are quoted frequently by HPB, are the Puranas. This term, Pura, means old, means formally. So this is from Pura, which simply means old, from ancient, old, O-L-D, from ancient times, formerly, belonging to ancient times. These are the stories, the history of ancient times. They are mythic, therefore. They deal with, they're very interesting stories in them. And they deal, often the Puranas are called the Fifth Veda, interestingly enough. You'll find this. They're often called the Fifth Veda. Most of them deal with creation, the creation of universe and creation of man, and that's why HPB quotes a great deal from it. They have legends relating to the period of Pralaya, many interesting legends relating to the period of Pralaya. They give the genealogy of our humanity in the Puranas, and the history of the universe, and also the history of the Manvantaras, which is called the recreational side, which is rather interesting, or perhaps we should say recreational, but I say recreational because the myth of Leela is found there, the myth that the universe was created as a sport of the gods. Now, there are said to be 18 major and 18 minor Puranas, but they are all divided into three according to the gunas, which I think is rather interesting. That is, according to the characteristics of the material, the primordial material, Mula Prakriti, the three principal characteristics, Rajas, Sattva, and Tamas. Rajas being, of course, the tremendous movement, rhythm, Sattva, the equilibrium, and Tamas, the inertia. And so one has, again, these two forces compromised by a third, as it were, are resolved by a third. So these are said to be divided then. So there are the Rajasa Puranas, which exalt Brahma, the creator, and the principal one in this is, of course, the Brahmanda Purana. Not very often read. Rather interesting. The second group, the Sattvika, and the two principal ones there are the Vishnu Purana, which HPB quotes a great deal, and the Bhagavata Purana. And then the third, again, the Rajasa exalts Brahma, the Sattvika exalts Vishnu, and the Tamasika exalts Shiva. And so you have the Shiva Purana and the Skanda Purana are the chief ones there. Skanda was the son of Shiva, in case you're wondering who he was. So it's rather interesting. They're divided according to the gunas, and the Puranas, if you want to read any of them, they're fascinating. There's the Sacred Books of the East series and various other ones that have been translated, and Zimmer, of course, has done some of them, and so on.
What about the word Skanda?
In this case, it's simply it's not the Buddhist Skanda. This is simply the son of Shiva. Now, the next group are called the Itihasas. It's an interesting word. Itta means it was like as like this, thus. And asa means indeed it was. Indeed it was like this, which is rather interesting. That's simply what it means. So we have itta or itti and ahasa. It was like this. And so the two, indeed it was this. And these are, again, legends, but of heroic history. Now we're getting down to the Odyssey and Iliad of Indian literature. This is the way it was. Indeed, it was like this. And so the two major Itihasas are the epics, the Ramayana, which was supposed to have been written by the great sage Valmiki, of course, and the Mahabharata, which is, of course, said to be written by Vyasa, the great saint, to whom who relates the story of Narada. Narada's appeal to Vishnu is related by the great saint Vyasa, may be a mythical name, or there may be several, you know, it's like Homer, you see. Homer is not necessarily a person, but a collectivity, maybe a mythical name, and so on. And so we have the Ramayana, which of course has a lot of action in it, and a lot of episodes. And Yana, of course, simply means story. That's all in this case. And the Mahabharata, which is, of course, again a compendium of stories. And actually, rather interestingly, all of the Puranic stories are repeated in the Mahabharata. Of course, the famous part of it, you know, as the Bhagavad Gita. Yeah. This round preceded every mammalian, the anthropoids included, in the animal kingdom. Adam Warkoff dealt with this so perfectly during our Secret Doctrine seminar in England this past summer that I secured the tape of his talk. He speaks very clearly, so I will tell you that the tape is very, very clear. But in order to help you, I have taken the central points. Tomorrow Diana will play the tape, and she will stop it periodically so that you can discuss some of these points and make sure that you have them in mind. Because what he is doing, of course, is to look at the biological model and the theosophical model. Now, the three diagrams, the first one, of course, is just general, of geologic ages, you will see, with the terms that were used in HPB's day and the contemporary terms, which is very helpful, I think, and the time scale as it is now currently accepted. Now, that can change again, but this is based not simply on fossils, but on both carbon and fluoride dating. Fluoride potassium dating, I think it is. Anyway, some of the modern methods of dating. But again, that can change, as we know. But I thought that would be helpful to see the geologic ages. The second diagram gives the position of generally contemporary paleoanthropology as it is today. And the numbers there are all millions of years. If you relate it, you see, to the other diagram, you begin to see the Oligocene period is somewhere between 40 and 30,000, and on this diagram, too, it's given as 35 million. I mean, not thousand, but million. So those numbers there deal with with millions of years. And this more or less shows the model according to science. Then, superimposing that, diagram three, is the suggestion of how that model relates to the theosophical position. HPB makes it clear that about the middle of the second root race, seven mammalian root stocks developed. And from one of these arose one of the seven primary stocks interbred with the lower apes in what was known as the Sin of the Mindless, the latter part of the third race. There was again an interbreeding, but this time of conscious man in the fourth race. And you'll see that with the lower apes from which came man and the anthropoid, which is rather interesting suggestion. Now, that is at least one way of solving this problem. And so the notes will give you then the basic information that will be helpful as you listen to the tape. And I have filled in at various places with quotations, as you will see, page 2, what is meant by astral, I've given you the full quotation, and some of these full quotations were not given on the tape, but I think this study notes will be useful. Yes, Virginia?
Doesn't HPB say somewhere that the anthropoids will reach the human stage at the end of this round?
Yes, that's right, yes. But this is how we could say that the man preceded every mammalian, the anthropoids included. And that's the question that Adam Warkoff was dealing with. So bring these with you, but glance through them tonight. I think it will be extremely helpful because this is it's a study talk. It's really packed full, and it was the next best thing then to getting Adam over here right away. He's promised to come in another year, and I thought this was extremely useful. And Diana will stop the tape periodically at points so that you can discuss it and really... which I think will be extremely helpful. I very much regret that I will not be with you tomorrow. I'll be on my way to Milwaukee, and tomorrow evening giving a public lecture in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So I have to be away. Now, would you like to hear the other story of Narada for your journey? It's a lovely story. It won't take very long. It's only 20 to 12, so I don't think it'll take much longer. Obviously, Narada was not content that he really knew Vishnu's power, you see. And so, after further austerities and devotional practices, Vishnu again comes and appears before him, and Narada says, I really didn't get the full impact of it. Even though I drowned in that pond and came out as a girl, I went through all of that. I still would like to know more, you see. This insatiable elephant's child wants to know more. Show me further the magic power of your Maya. And the god replies, okay, by this time he's through arguing with him, and says, all right, come with me. But again with that ambiguous smile on his beautifully curved lips. I love that. So from the pleasant shadow of the sheltering hermit grove, Vishnu conducted Narada across a bare stretch of land which blazed like metal under the merciless glow of a scorching sun. The two were soon very thirsty. At some distance, in the glaring light, they perceived the thatched roofs of a tiny hamlet. Vishnu asked, "Will you go over there and fetch me some water?" "Certainly, O Lord," Narada replied, and he made off to the distant group of huts, and the god relaxed under the shadow of a cliff to await his return. When Narada reached the hamlet, he knocked at the first door. A beautiful maiden opened to him, and the holy man experienced something of which he had never up to the time dreamed, the enchantment of her eyes. They resembled those of his divine lord and friend. He stood and gazed. He simply forgot his errand. The girl, gentle and candid, bade him welcome. Her voice was a golden noose about his neck. As though moving in a vision, he entered the door. The occupants of the house were full of respect for him, yet not the least bit shy. He was honorably received as a holy man, yet somehow not as a stranger, rather as an old and venerable acquaintance who had been a long time away. Narada remained with them, impressed with their cheerful and noble bearing, and feeling entirely at home. Nobody asked him what he had come for. He seemed to have belonged to the family from time immemorial. And after a certain period, he asked the father for permission to marry the girl, which was no more than anyone in the house had been expecting him to do. He became a member of the family, and shared with them the age-old burdens and simple delights of a peasant household. 12 years passed. He had three children. When his father-in-law died, he became head of the household, inheriting the estate and managing it, tending the cattle and cultivating the fields. The 12th year, the rainy season was extraordinarily violent. The streams swelled, torrents poured down the hills, and the little village was inundated by a sudden flood. In the night, the straw huts and cattle were carried away and everyone fled. With one hand supporting his wife, with the other leading two of his children and bearing the smallest on his shoulder, Narada set forth hastily. Forging ahead through the pitch darkness and lashed by the rain, he waded through slippery mud, staggered through whirling waters. The burden was more than he could manage with the current heavily dragging at his legs. Once, when he stumbled, the child slipped from his shoulder and disappeared into the roaring night. With a desperate cry, Narada let go the older children to catch at the smallest, but was too late. Meanwhile, the flood swiftly carried off the other two, and even before he could realize the disaster, ripped from his side his wife, swept his own feet from under him, and flung him headlong in the torrent like a log. Unconscious, Narada was stranded eventually on a little cliff. When he returned to consciousness, he opened his eyes upon a vast sheet of muddy water. He could only weep. "Child," he heard a familiar voice which nearly stopped his heart. "Where is the water you went to fetch for me? I have been waiting more than half an hour." That's the power of Narada. How long have you been here? Thank you very much.